This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire Division of Children, Youth, and Families is charged with protecting kids from abuse and neglect. But DCYF has faced a storm of criticism for failing to do so after two little girls known to the agency were killed, allegedly at the hands of their own parents. These deaths prompted an independent review of the child protection system, and here's what it basically said, that state officials helped set the stage that allowed these tragedies to happen by massively understaffing DCYF and by passing laws that critics say are more designed to protect parents than children. That's what we're looking at today in The Exchange as part of NPR and NHPR's effort on the first 100 days at the White House and the State House. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Lorraine Bartlett is here, director of the Division of Children, Youth and Families, or DCYF. She's been with the agency for 28 years. Lorraine, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dimitrios Charos. He's a child protection services worker with DCYF and a former police officer. Dimitri today is speaking on behalf of himself and not all DCYF workers. And Dimitrios, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Joining us by phone is Dr. Wendy Gladstone. She's a child abuse pediatrician from Exeter. She's been looking at these issues for a long, long time. And Dr. Gladstone, very nice to have you. Thank you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, Dimitrios, I think you first, your broad reactions to the conclusions of this report.
Broad reaction? I looked over the report. It's fairly lengthy, dense with information. Wouldn't say I have it memorized word for word, but really the main points that it came down to, that it summarized as far as, a need for increased staffing, funding, resources, training, retention. My opinion was that it was all pretty on the money.
Did you feel vindicated that, you'd been complaining about these issues for a long time and here's this independent reviewer who says, yeah, it's really hard for these folks to do their jobs when they don't have enough people?
Actually, yeah, it was vindication in the sense of, when I first found out, or we all, I guess everyone, found out that this audit was happening, I felt pretty confident in the job that I do as a worker. And I thought, as long as this is as honest and independent and subjective, it's going to show that folks like me do the job the best we can under difficult circumstances with what we have. So, yeah, I would say it was vindication.
Well, I have a lot more questions about how you do the work that you do and some of the laws and policies surrounding that. But Lorraine Bartlett, you too, what's your reaction to this?
So my reaction to this was that there were not a lot of surprises in the report. Concerns relative to our having the human resources needed to be able to do the work have been on the rise for the past 3 years, more so over the past 2 years. I think that when the supervisors that were able to attend the public report out from the Center for Supportive Families heard the findings, I don't know if I'd use the word vindicated as much as they felt validated, that they were aware of what was going on. And certainly I appreciated that the report kind of put forth sequential recommendations around what we can do. I think that it presents an opportunity for us to truly work with others in building the strong foundation we need to be able to serve the children and families in New Hampshire the way we want to, the way our child protective worker staffs want to be able to, as well as their supervisors and administration in
the
department.
Why a couple of years ago, Lorraine?
So a couple of years ago, what I would say is that I think that we all know that the opioid crisis and the drug crisis in New Hampshire has been on the rise. And about the same time that we started to see an increase in the use of heroin and now fentanyl in New Hampshire, we saw an increase in the number of protective reports coming in that spoke to substance abuse, but also an increase in the number of overall reports in New Hampshire. So in state fiscal year 2014, you saw about a little over 9,000 reports. By state fiscal year 2016, we saw around 10,525 reports with the same number of staff trying to manage that work. And we began to see a significant turnover and challenges around our retention. So we typically had about a 25 to 30% turnover rate in assessment staff around 2013, 2014.
That sounds like a lot.
Well, by 2015 and into 16, it went up to 50%. So you had a workforce capacity of about 64% of the total number of people you needed to do the work. So out of 84 social workers, there was typically 54 to 58 of them available to manage all of those protective reports.
So just clarify what that turnover rate means. So that means every year, half your staff is leaving?
Every year, about 50% of CPSWs in assessment were leaving and or in training because we're hiring new staff to cover the backlog. And we also, unfortunately, in our child protective worker staff in DCYF, have a pretty high FMLA rate as a result of overload and stress related to the work.
FMLA means what?
Family medical leave. The ability to, I have to take some time because I'm not managing this as well as I need to. And they're not available to do the work because they're out.
Dr. Gladstone, I want to turn to you again. The two big findings of the report, and we'll talk about all of them, but the two big findings, state officials really helped, as I said, set the stage that allowed these things to happen. Understaffing, underfunding DCYF, and passing laws that, actually quoting you here, that you said were more designed to protect parents than to protect children. What do you think about this whole independent review?
I think it's excellent that it's come out when it has, given the challenges that Lorraine has described her staff having. My interactions with the staff are frequently, if not always, I'm very impressed by how hard the staff works and how they make do with what they have, even though sometimes they're stretched thin. Sometimes the laws that we reference that can get in the way have to do with policies that workers have to follow when they're trying to evaluate a child to be sure they're safe. So, for example, if a worker wants to talk with a child or talk with a family, instead of them being able to go and carry on a conversation and try to figure out what status a child has, they're required to first tell family members that they don't have to talk to DCYF. And when you start a conversation that way, that can make it difficult sometimes with some kinds of families to get the information you need to determine if a child is safe.
So is that a law, Lorraine Bartlett, that the legislature passed, or is that an internal DCYF policy that you guys have decided is the best way to conduct business?
It's a law. Our staff, when their first initial encounter with a family, unless there's reason to believe that advising the family that we're going to be involved would place the child at greater risk of harm, they're required to provide the family with what's called a family rights brochure and inform them that they do not have to allow us into their home, they do not have to allow us to interview their children, and they, for all intent and purposes, don't need to cooperate with the investigation. Families actually sign off on that brochure as part of the assessment. And I think that what we have found is that initially families are often willing to sign it and allow us to have the conversation. But when we start digging deeper into the family situation, particularly needing to speak to other children, not just child victims, many families will invoke their right not to have further involvement in the course of that protective investigation.
So a family doesn't have to go along with anything that your agency is trying to do?
They do not need to necessarily cooperate, no.
At what point do they need to cooperate? I mean, again, two little girls were killed.
Well, we have had, with the support of the legislature over the last couple of years, we had Senate Bill 244 pass, and then we also had a Senate bill, and I apologize, I don't remember the number, that allows us to now seek a court order if a family refuses to allow us entry into the home. And also, at this point, if we made the determination that a child was in imminent danger and we needed to take action, we can contact the court directly to advise that we need to do immediate removal. But we still have the family rights brochure that we use as part of our protective investigation process.
How often, Demetrios, do you have to take extra measures, as Lorraine is describing, to get into a home to investigate?
Well, personally, my experience, fortunately, I haven't had to do it very often. I've been working in the Manchester office since May of 2011, and I think maybe two or three times I've had to, say, contact law enforcement to assist me as far as if we get a report that says a child could be in, you know, imminent or immediate danger or whatnot, and whoever's answering the phone is not being cooperative, where I've had to contact the PD. And I'm fortunate that I feel like my department, at least in my Manchester office, has a good working relationship with the Manchester PD. They've been able to assist me.
So sometimes the police have to help you go in.
They do. And I think it's just, again, you know, they're showing up, they're in uniform, there's that command presence that does assist us. I mean, obviously, it's two different disciplines, what we do between, you know, the child protective service work and law enforcement, two different areas of the law, but they are able to assist us. So I've been fortunate myself where I've been pretty persuasive in being able to explain to parents, yes, you have this right. You have a right to not allow me into your home. You have a right to not allow me to speak with your child. However, I've got this report screened in by law. I need to be able to see your child to make sure your child's not in imminent danger.
What do you think about what Dr. Gladstone says and the point that the report makes, too, that partly the problems we've seen at DCYF are staffing, but partly it's the laws that have been set up? Again, Dr. Gladstone was widely quoted as saying the laws seem more designed to protect parents than children. What do you think, Demetrios?
Sure. Regarding the law, I mean, what I do for work, I feel, you know, it's within everything I try to do is within the scope of the law. So when I do a job or do this job, it's not always a matter of whether I agree with the law or not, but I always want to make sure I'm giving people, you know, they're afforded their right to due process.
Do the laws hold you back from better protecting kids? That's a
tough question. I feel my experience is that I've always been able to do an adequate job. Again, as far as being able to assess if a child's in imminent or immediate danger. Now, you know, could those laws, because the parents don't have to cooperate, they don't have to let me into their home, they have the right to not allow me to interview, to speak to their children, say the child victim or even the siblings. You know, could that get in the way of doing a what we like to think of as a very thorough assessment? It does. But I do feel that I'm able to do a good job as far as assessing for immediate danger or imminent harm.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, immediate danger versus assessing risk, because that's something else this reviewer honed in on. But let me also remind our listeners that you can join us. Any questions or comments you have about reforms to New Hampshire's child protection system, specifically the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. We're looking at what an independent reviewer said about this, revealing an agency understaffed, overwhelmed by rising caseloads, and problems compounded by weak laws that may make it harder to protect children. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Gladstone, so let's talk about what Demetrios just said. Immediate harm versus risk. This is a point that the reviewer makes repeatedly, that DCYF is pretty good at intervening when harm has occurred, but not good at assessing and managing risk. You know, the feeling that nothing has appeared to have happened yet, but there are red flags all over the place. What do you think, Dr. Gladstone?
Oh, that's a hard call. It involves making some judgments. It involves getting sufficient amount of information, factual information, and ultimately making a call, is this child at risk? It's it's a decision I don't envy DCOF having to make as often as they have to.
What kind of judgments, Dr. Gladstone?
Well, one medical judgment, which I'll speak to being a physician, has to do with when children are injured. And trying to make a judgment about, was this injury accidental? Was this injury inflicted? Did this injury result from neglect of a child's safety that put them at risk for a fall, a burn, an injury of some kind? So one way that assessing child safety can be more accurate is a close collaboration between child protection and a medical provider who's aware of these issues.
And Lorraine, I want to bring you into this too, but another question for you as a medical provider, Dr. Gladstone. The report also says that it's hard for outsiders who are interested in a child's life, teachers, doctors, police officers, coaches, whatever, that sometimes it's hard for them to connect with DCYF to say, look, I've got some concerns. I see Johnny every day at school and I'm really upset. I wonder what you think as a doctor about that.
Well, the reporting requirements and the reporting procedures for when we as medical professionals need to report to DCYF, I think is very clear. And I don't consider that a barrier, except that it does require somebody to take the time and effort to do it.
So that's the problem.
Sometimes it can be a problem. I think the reporting procedure itself means you have to take time away from what you're doing, sit down, get the information together, and call the main lumber and explain what your situation is. Actually, studies show that the biggest reason that medical providers don't make reports when they're worried or suspicious is because they perceive that there isn't going to be something helpful done as a result. And one of the points that the report made had to do with strengthening the collaboration between medical providers and DCYF, as well as other professional groups like educators, for example.
What about the harm versus risk, Lorraine Merrill? Again, the report says you guys are pretty good at intervening when actual harm has occurred, but not so great at, you know, managing risk. You know, alarm bells may be going off, but you're not really sure what to do about that.
One of the challenges I think we face in regard to the law is the definition of neglect requires that we show harm or that the child is very likely to suffer serious impairment. And as you yourself stated, I think that the report is very clear that we do a good job of assessing immediate danger and immediate safety. Our capacity to do a comprehensive assessment, again, is impacted by resources and the ability of a worker to get back out there and check on those facts. But when you look at trying to make an informed decision about whether or not we have the facts to show that a child is very likely to suffer serious impairment, one of the things that the report speaks to, and I think it's an opportunity for us to be working with our staff, our own attorneys, parents, attorneys in the court, is the interpretation of the statute. The definition of founded is very clear that it gives a person reasonable cause to believe that a child has been harmed, abused, or neglected. And yet the, you know, when you come to the evidentiary hearing, you have to provide a preponderance of the evidence. And a preponderance of the evidence speaks to you need the facts of the situation.
Not just that unsettled feeling in your stomach that something might be wrong.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Lots more to talk about coming up, including we'll talk with two state lawmakers on their role in fixing New Hampshire's child protection system. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, reforming the state's child protection system. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Lorraine Bartlett is here, Director of the Division of Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF. She's been with the agency for 28 years. Dimitrios Charos is here. He's a child protection services worker with DCYF, a former police officer. Dimitrios is speaking on behalf of himself and not all DCYF workers. Joining us by phone is Dr. Wendy Gladstone, a child abuse pediatrician from Exeter who has been involved in these issues for a long time in the state. One more time, that exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us now is Representative Skip Berrien. He's a Democrat from Exeter and a member of the Commission to Review Child Abuse Fatalities. And Representative Berrien, nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be with you and to discuss this very important issue that faces this state.
Well, we've been looking a lot at the report earlier, but to you, Representative Berrien, moving forward, what's your responsibility as a state lawmaker to take the next step so that kids in abusive homes aren't harmed or even killed, as we've seen? What's the first thing that you do?
Well, I'd just like to say that my experience with DCYF workers has always been very positive. I've always found them to be very dedicated, and I've always recognized the limitations that they're working under. But it is among what I consider the hardest work in the state that these workers have to undertake. But in reviewing the report. I think an overall message is that there's really been a very narrow scope of what the state's child protection system really is, and part of that there are many ways in which that has happened. Some of this certainly is legislative. Some of it, as we've heard, is due to staffing issues and the way staff is trained. There are internal policies which certainly restrict the work that we can accomplish, and we have lots of issues in terms of the way laws and policies are put forth. So I think from the standpoint of what we hear from this report and what our observation has been from the legislature is that there is a massive understaffing. Of the agency, and that until we can really address that issue, it's really hard to move beyond that.
Well, how much would it cost, Representative Berrien, to bring DCYF to what you consider adequate staffing?
Well, I think that that's something that our physical people are certainly going to have to struggle with and come up with. It's my hope that Commissioner Myers has been working with the governor to propose a budget which will address that issue, and possibly Director Bartlett may have more information on that than we have at this point in the legislature, but certainly there is going to be a need for a significant increase in appropriation.
What about the laws and policies themselves, Representative Berrien? The review says that state laws focus too much on family unification, less on child protection. How fair is that assessment?
Well, when it comes to statutes, there's always the issue of interpretation of statutes. And in reviewing those statutes, I think there are some real concerns that we've had on the commission that we are just starting to approach. As you may be aware, there also is going to be a joint committee between the House and the Senate to address these recommendations. And so I think that we do have to go back and review all of the statutes, particularly those definitional issues, which over the past decades, it appears that we certainly have had a tendency to really protect the integrity of families versus the safety of children.
Where does that that philosophy or that idea come from? That family unification is, you know, a very important goal. I don't want to say the most important goal, but a very important goal, to the point where this review says it's gone overboard and kids aren't well protected. Where does that come from, that philosophy behind these laws?
Well, I think that Dr. Gladstone and Director Bartlett and maybe even Dimitri in his experience will recognize that there's been a swing of pendulums over time. Over the decades, there's been, you know, certainly back in the 1970s, there was a real emphasis on the protection of children, and then we realized that sometimes we were interfering with family dynamics by separating children from their families, and then the swing of the pendulum kind of went the other way towards family reunification. And so I think that if you look at our laws, a lot of them were written back in the 1970s and 1980s and some modifications in the 1990s. But so I think that we're kind of, again, at one extreme of the pendulum, and that we're having to really explore that carefully and see that we're doing the best for children.
Why is it so hard to get it right, Representative Berrien? I've heard others say what you say, you know, we went too far in one direction 30 years ago, and then maybe 15 years ago or so, we went too far in the other direction, you know, favoring unification over perhaps and overlooking perhaps some dangerous family dynamics for kids. Why is it so hard to, you know, put the pendulum where it belongs, right in the middle?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question. I think there are probably many factors that go into it. I think that there's certainly some cultural factors, social factors that go into that, which affect that. But and it's important also to note that this is not a unique problem in New Hampshire. Yes, we have suffered some unfortunate situations here which have brought this to our attention, and we're fortunate to have this report to be able to bring everyone back to the table to see if we can sort these issues out. But all states have struggled with these same issues, and I think it's, as I say, cultural and social and our research too. Certainly, I think the research on brain development in children has certainly advanced our thinking in terms of what are many of the risks to children in their environment, and which includes family dynamics as well.
Well, Representative Berrien, last question for you. So how do you keep this on the front burner and moving forward? There are so many other concerns that the state has, from basics like, you know, roads and bridges to dealing with, you know, the opioid crisis, which I understand is related to child protection. How do you keep it on the front burner and moving ahead, given all that's going on in the state?
Well, I think that comes both from our political will to be able to move things ahead. We have to bring the public along on these issues. But this joint committee will be proposing legislation to be able to address these recommendations. But in addition, I'd also like to mention that the commission has been reviewing a proposal to have a child advocate, Office of Child Advocate here in New Hampshire. And that would be a position that would provide oversight of the child protection system ongoing on a permanent basis. And so that's another consideration that would certainly help to keep this on the front burner.
Well, Representative Berrien, we've taken a lot of your time. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much again for your attention to this important problem.
Representative Skip Berrien, he's a former doctor, he's a Democrat from Exeter, and a member of the Commission to Review Child Abuse Fatalities. Again, join us as we look at reforming New Hampshire's child protection system. We've talked a lot about the problems. What do you see as some of the solutions? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails have come in. I'd love to put them in front of all of you. Here's one from Nancy, who says, since 1988, in my role as a licensed clinical social worker at community mental health, school systems, and private practice, one constant in my dealing with DCYF employees is that they have never, Nancy says, capitalized enough financial support and resources to do their jobs. We asked so much of fellow human beings who have one of the most difficult jobs in working with incredibly vulnerable populations, and we as a state have given so little, Nancy says. If we want to invest in the future of the state, we need to put our money directly in our resources, human beings and kids, prevention and protection. versus adding to the impact of stress on the health of our population. Nancy, thank you for the email. And I wonder what you think, Dr. Gladstone, how you've observed this issue over the many years that you've been involved.
I think Nancy's comments are terrific. Good for you for sending that in. It is true that if we want to make progress, we have to fund and support what's important. As Dr. Berrien said, we have more and more research showing that the effects of adverse experiences on children when they're young have enormous implications, not just for the child, but for the people around them and for society as a whole as they age and become elderly people. And so unless we're doing the most we can possibly do to support children early on, we're going to run into trouble later on.
Well, in fact, here's an email from Linda that just came in to that point. She says, I live in Hillsboro. I work in community mental health for adults. One thing Linda says that has come to my attention in my work is that some of my clients that I have come into contact with as adults have had contact with DCYF as children, and they report that DCYF failed them in New Hampshire and attribute some of their current mental health issues to their childhood trauma growing up in a risky environment. Linda says this is important to take a look at. It seems the lack of management of DCYF's risk assessment may attribute to an overloaded mental health system as these kids grow up. Linda, thank you for that point, kind of reiterating what Dr. Gladstone just said. This gets back also, Lorraine Bartlett, to the issue again of risk assessment. We keep getting back to this, that it's hard for DCYF to assess the risks and do something with them. Hard to get the facts, as you say. What would help you get the facts better?
So when you speak about risk assessment and you want to do a comprehensive assessment as a child protective service worker, I think that risk assessment takes time. And I know that I've heard Dr. Gladstone speak to it. I've heard Representative Berrien speak to it, that you need to have the resources. And you need to have the resources in two specific ways. One, you need to have the staff resources to be able to do those comprehensive assessments. And if you're working in an office, as Demetrios does in Manchester, where instead of 10 to 12 protective reports a month, that you could actually manage that risk assessment and spend the time with the family, make the collateral contacts with the professionals and others to get the information you need, you're managing 25 to 30 new protective reports a month. It's very difficult to find the time to get all of that done. And you're moving more often than not from crisis to crisis. The other piece is you need to have the service array. You need to have the services that you can refer those families to be able to address the trauma those children are experiencing, to be able to address the substance use disorder or domestic violence issues or other parenting issues that families are having. And we don't have the full array of services, particularly children's mental health services, that we need throughout the state of New Hampshire. We have taken action to initiate trauma screenings of our children in our open family service cases so that we have ongoing assessment. But you can still have children waiting months for an intake and then longer to get in for an appointment to begin addressing those adverse childhood experiences that are impacting them socially, emotionally, physically, and educationally.
Well, and from what I understand, so even if there are services available, you know, drug abuse support, mental health services that would help a family get out of crisis, sometimes they don't access those services and there's no requirement that they do so. So you, the social worker, Demetrios, I'll turn to you. You may say, you know, look, I really see a problem with your drug abuse. You know, it's harmful to your child if you're passed out three nights a week from drinking too much or taking drugs. Here's where you can go in Manchester to get substance abuse treatment. And the person says, yeah, that's great. But they don't have to do it, do they?
Correct. I mean, if there's actually a case established where there's a legal relationship with the family, services to an extent can be ordered, can be put into place. But if it's an assessment, you know, an investigation, if you will, a report that I'm following up on, I can make the referral to agencies. And there are a lot of, I should say a lot, but there's a fair amount of decent agencies in Manchester that I do make referrals to. And we try to encourage the parents to follow up with them. But again, as Lorraine said, and she pretty much hit it on the head as far as the numbers of reports that come in, 10 to 12 reports a month for, say, someone like me, say the average assessment worker, very, very much doable. You can do that initial risk, that initial face-to-face, you're assessing for immediate danger, but you also have the time to do the follow-up, to make the follow-up phone calls, to do a follow-up home visit. When you're getting, like Lorraine said, the 25 to 30, I've had months where I've had over 30 reports. And then when you put that in the context of, the average month has, say, 20 business days, and you're getting that many reports, and then you figure, with each report you get, you have, X amount of phone calls, you got to do the home visit, you got to interview people. You're talking a lot of work even with just 10 or 12. And then when you're pushing north of 20, it really becomes almost like, for me, it's like triage. I'm getting a report. I'm going out to the house. I'm seeing the kids. I'm seeing that they're safe. I try to impart for some words of wisdom and make some, referrals for service if it's needed. And then it's literally, I have to move on. Ideally, I do try to follow back up with the more high-risk situations. But it's really, it's triage. It's doing the best you can limited time and resources.
You sort of making a judgment call. House A seems a little questionable, but maybe not so bad. I'm going to move on to house B. Oh, things look worse there. I mean, you must just be crossing your fingers every time you leave a place and going, I hope I made the right decision.
Actually, you are correct in the sense there is a lot of discretion put into the hands of a CPSW. And I think the division, does a pretty good job as far as trying to find the best applicants and vetting them and going through their background, the interview process. So you are correct. I think there is a fair amount of discretion put into the hands of a CPSW.
Well, who's sending the reports into you, Demetrios? I mean, do you usually get reports from neighbors, doctors like Dr. Gladstone, teachers? Where do they come in from?
Really all over the place. In New Hampshire, by law, everyone is a mandated reporter.
Everyone.
Everyone.
So if I see something at my neighbor's house, I'm required to report
it. Yeah, and you feel a child has been
abused. Not that I do, by the way, if my neighbors happen to be listening. It must be a prickly situation, though, Demetrios, right? I mean, you call somebody and you say, hello, Mrs. Jones, there's been a report of child abuse at your house. I mean, people must feel, kind of defensive.
You really got to use some tact. I got to tell you, if this doesn't work out, I have a great career as a salesman because I'm the ultimate cold caller. So, yeah, using experience, tact, understanding, knowledge.
All
absolutely.
Right. We'll talk a lot more after a short break. And we'll turn to another lawmaker, Republican John Reagan, who's on the advisory board at DCYF. We'll get his thoughts as well. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at all the attention on reforming the state's child protection system. It's part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We've been looking at a recent report, an independent reviewer of New Hampshire's Division of Children, Youth, and Families, revealing an agency understaffed, overwhelmed by rising caseloads, and all problems compounded by, as we're hearing, weak laws that make it harder for social workers to protect children. We'd love your questions, comments, thoughts, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. Lauren joins us from Manchester. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Laura.
Sure.
As an interviewer, you asked a whole bunch of the questions that I was actually thinking about from the lawmakers as to what they're going to be able to do quickly to make some changes in the laws. And the idea of the pendulum swinging back and forth. I've been living in this state for 30 plus years, and I've seen that kind of thing happening with the DCYF. Sometimes they would go in and take a child too quickly and then find out that that wasn't the right thing. But now they're, you know, they've made laws so that Child Protective Services can't go in and take a child as quickly, even when they are in imminent danger. And I understand that the staffing is just so stretched thin that it makes it really difficult to handle all of the cases that they have. But what about the budget? How about, are we able to do any emergency budget changes so that DCYF can have more money to, pay more people right away? And also, I was wondering what the connection between DCYF and CASA may have to help protect the children better, because CASA is another agency that is out there advocating for children. And I had heard one of the interviewees talk about having an advocate for the children. I do understand that the parents also have to pay for advocacy as well.
Lots of questions, and I want to let you know, and thank you for calling. I want to let you know that in just a minute, we're going to have another lawmaker on who's been looking at these issues. So we'll ask him your question about an emergency budget allocation and so forth. But what about advocates, Dr. Gladstone, for kids, for parents? Is there enough out there for either of these parties?
Lauren's referencing a nonprofit in the state called Court-Appointed Special Advocates, or CASA. And these are volunteers who are specially trained in how to support children who are involved in, for example, the foster care system. It's a wonderful resource for children. It's a wonderful resource for families and also for DCYF, because they know that there is someone there getting involved who's speaking directly in the child's best interest, and that's their number one priority. Part of the problem, as we talked about earlier, is having enough people advocate for children on a professional level, and that can include mental health providers. There is a shortage of adequate mental health providers, both therapists and also child psychiatrists, particularly in some areas of the state where you just can't find them without a lot of effort. So those are other advocates or resources for children that we should support, just as we should be supporting DCOF more thoroughly.
Well, let's bring into our conversation Senator John Reagan. He's a Republican from Deerfield. He's on the advisory board of DCYF. And Senator Reagan, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for the invitation, Laura.
Well, you just heard from our caller, Lauren, who said, look, is there some sort of emergency budget measure that can be taken to start working on these problems right away? The budget process, as you know, takes 6 months. What do you think, Senator Reagan?
I'm at my wit's end listening to this program and listening to all the excuses about why we can't do what we're supposed to be doing. This is a properly funded department, and the leadership of the department has not made anybody aware of these problems. So on the DC Life Advisory Board, we're routinely given a song and dance about the state of things and how distressing things are, but I carry a lot of legislation for the Department of Health and Human Services, always have. Nobody from there has asked me to introduce any legislation to do with the problems and the shortcomings at DCYF. So it's a matter of leadership. We don't need a review committee. We just had an audit by a professional organization from Maryland that came in and audited what we were doing, and they gave us the recommendations. So this is what we need to do, is do the recommendations. We don't need to keep talking about it. We know what we have to do, and we need the will to go ahead and do it.
One of the big recommendations, in fact, probably the biggest recommendation that the independent reviewer said, was more money. The DCYF is massively understaffed and can't improve until it has more funding. So I wonder what you think about that, Senator Reagan.
Like I said, there's been no appeal. There's been nobody that's carried that message to the legislature. There's ways to get more money for emergencies, and there's ways to get more money. Now, this is an agency that is funded for so many positions, and the positions are not filled. And granted, we need to expand that base number, but the basic number's not filled. So there's probably a recruiting failure, but it's there. These positions are funded. We're not asking to create a new department. We're asking the department that exists to do what they're supposed to be doing, and if not, we don't need excuses. We need leadership. We need a plan.
I'm going to get Lorraine Bartlett to talk about that, but one more question for you, Senator Reagan. The other big point that the independent reviewer made is that the laws that the legislature put in place over the years too strongly favor parents, family reunification, making it too difficult for Child Protective Services workers to go in there and work with families, protect kids who are at risk. I wonder what you think. We've heard a lot about the pendulum swinging one way and now the other way in a direction that makes it hard to protect children.
Last year, I sponsored a piece of legislation that would have given a little more muscle to the department when they wanted to intervene in a very suspicious situation for children. And the committee defeated it because they were too concerned about an imagined violation of parents' rights. So you have to, in this case, you have to trust the judgment of those caseworkers, and you have to allow them to proceed, and you have to not leave the judiciary and the caseworkers and the attorneys and the police officers. You can't leave them in a state of confusion, and this is another failure of management. Just to see this and get it explained and get it done.
So that particular part, the review of the laws, making the laws, it sounds like you agree that the policies need to be changed to make it easier for social workers to get in there.
Yes.
Is that DCYF's fault or lawmakers' fault?
It's a failure of leadership to come to the legislature and say, I need you to do in this, and in that particular case, we were dealing with opiate-addicted mothers. The legislature has to be a little more realistic about what we have to do to protect whom. So, somebody needs to present that case, and I'll continue my advocacy for the department. And see that I have an appointment now with the budget director, the governor, to make sure that he's aware of, you know, this other need, because when you're shuffling priorities, sometimes the loudest voice gets the most money.
Lorraine Bartlett, I do want to let you jump in. Again, you've been director at DCYF since 2014, been with the agency a long time. What do you think, that either DCYF or the broader Health and Human Services Department didn't make the case strongly enough that kids were in danger because of lack of resources and weak laws?
I'll be honest and say that I can't speak to what happened before I became director, or Senator's Reagan's opinion relative to leadership. I think that what we have in front of us, as he just said, is a report that now affords us the opportunity to truly look at those recommendations and take action to strengthen the child protective system in New Hampshire. I think that rather than reacting, we have an opportunity to truly respond to those recommendations. I do want to say that when we were asked by the Commission on Child Abuse Fatalities to take a look at establishing 24/7 response and also looking at our resources to be able to do that, I began meeting with Commissioner Myers in March of 2016 and really putting forth what the concerns were about our resources. He has been a fierce advocate for what we need. I think Demetrios could speak to the fact that technology has been provided to our staff to have laptops and iPhones, something that we really didn't have budgetary support for before. And our field staff now have laptops, and the iPhones have been rolling out sequentially.
So they can file reports from the field and move on to the next
case. They can do their work out in the field as opposed to have to coming back and forth to the offices that they work in, which is a challenge geographically, especially when you get up into the North Country. We did take funded positions from within the department to create 22 new positions, 5 assistant supervisors, and 17 new CPSWs that was approved by the governor and council the end of November that are being posted. Of this year, November 22nd of 2016. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting we're in 17.
Me too. I made this mistake the other day.
And we're actively recruiting. We actually have established a mass recruitment effort where those positions are posted so that there's a single hiring manager and individuals can indicate on their applications what geographical locations they want to work in New Hampshire. We've had contact with all of the schools of social work in New England to make them aware. We've worked with Employment Security that created a flyer for us. We have a staff person that's going out regularly to job fairs as well as to Employment Security offices. So we do have some enhanced recruitment efforts. We've also, as part of our 24/7, created a noon to 8 p.m. shift, and we have hired so far 11 of 15 new CPSWs to work that shift. To help support the day shift, but also be available into the evening to help. So I think that we're on the right road. I do know that the commissioner is seriously looking at, as we move into the governor's phase of the budget, what are the additional resources that the Division for Children, Youth, and Families needs, as well as the department as a whole.
Dr. Gladstone, I want to bring you into this. And Senator Reagan, please stay on the line. We appreciate you being with us. Dr. Gladstone, what do you think about what Senator Reagan says? You know, the advocacy hasn't been forceful enough. People haven't come forward loudly enough to say, look, there's a problem here.
Well, I can't speak to that in general since I don't work at the legislature. I defer to Senator Reagan's experience that way. There's no question that our legislative process invites, not just allows, but invites people to come and speak to issues. I know I've personally seen that myself happening. If Senator Reagan feels it's been inadequate to address the issues raised by this independent report, then, as Lorraine says, we now have the report in front of us, and now it's time to respond to it.
Senator Reagan, last question for you. So where do you think this should go from here? And what do you do in your role as a state lawmaker and also, as I said, on the advisory board of DCYF?
The advisory board is very frustrated by what we deal with. And we'll continue to advocate and we'll, you know, we have the governor's preparing their budget and the commissioner has to advocate for his positions, and if he's looking for a, you know, you're in a position if you're trying to do a an unexpanded budget that money may have to be shifted from some agency into HHS to help out with these things, but I still insist that we need to deal with the things we're aware of now and get this situation to a positive resolution. And I think we have the resources now to do it. This isn't a failure of resources.
It's a failure to get up and moving with those resources.
Right.
Senator Reagan, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Again, that's Senator John Reagan, Republican from Deerfield, on the advisory board of DCYF. Demetrios, I'd love to get your thoughts. Has there been forceful enough advocacy? Senator Reagan says there's enough money, you just need to get moving with it.
Is Senator Reagan still on the phone?
No.
Oh, too bad.
Because we're closing out the hour.
I kind of wanted to respond to him directly. My response to, I was listening to Senator Reagan. He brought up some decent points. Talking about excuses, and, he's saying, agency, folks making excuses, resources are adequate. I'd like to have Senator Reagan try to come out in the field with me for a few weeks, and we'll see if his attitude is still that we're adequately funded and staffed and we have all the resources we need.
Two last quick emails, and I do apologize for throwing these at you very quickly. Please have your guests tell listeners how to report suspected abuse or risk issues. This is an email from Grace. Lorraine Bartlett?
So to report abuse and neglect, first of all, I'd say err on the side of the caution. If you have concerns, call 1-800-894-5533. That's our central intake number, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. There are trained social workers there prepared to take the report and walk you through obtaining the information.
Okay. We will put that number on our website, and we have to close it out there. But I think this conversation is going to continue as the legislative season opens and as some of these recommendations from the report are put into place. I want to thank everybody very much for being with us, Lorraine Bartlett, Demetrios Charros, and Dr. Gladstone. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, burning wood, biomass energy as alternative fuel. Many New Hampshire households use wood pellet stoves for heat, and now schools and businesses are also turning to biomass to generate heat and electricity. But questions abound about the sustainability and carbon output of this alternative energy source. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.